Welcome to another edition of the NHL Executive Suite. I'm Deb Placey, and we have with us Bill Foley, a 1967 graduate of West Point, a businessman and entrepreneur, and he has become known in sports as the owner of the Vegas Golden Knights. So thank you so much for doing this. We're really happy to have you here.
It's great to be here, Deb. Thanks.
So for a lot of reasons, including which we'll talk about, turning a tidy profit on Wall Street while training as a cadet, reshaping the title insurance market, countless real estate deals, and a few dozen wineries later, plus the early success, really, of the Vegas Golden Knights. You have been called the most interesting man in hockey. What do you think of that?
Well, I've had a good run. I can say that. We've had a really good run, but it was hard work all the way, and it was putting together the right team in terms of the management group and the hockey ops staff to get the job done. And we were prepared. You know, when the season started and the draft happened, we were well prepared, and that's the secret to our success.
We're going to get into some of your secrets for success. I think anybody listening would. It's a bit of a chance to get some advice from you, I guess, and listening to how you were able to find success in so many different fields. So I'm going to pick your brain a little bit. Why was sports ownership, to start with, a smart play for you? Because it started with the NFL, right, and your interest in buying the Jacksonville Jaguars?
It did, and I became friends with Wayne Weaver, and Wayne wanted to move on, and we had worked out kind of a general plan of a minority position and majority position over a period of time. And the reality was Jacksonville's a great town, and we have a lot of businesses located there. But I really didn't want to spend the rest of my days in the East and have to fly west for my recreation. So I moved away from an East Coast team or a Midwestern team and started thinking about West Coast opportunities. And hockey, because I had a long ago affiliation with it, or not affiliation, but I played hockey as a kid. I always loved hockey, and I wanted to reconnect with it. And the stars aligned for us to get a team in Las Vegas, which is a great town. It's in the West. My wineries are in Northern California and Southern California and Oregon. And I have a home in Montana. So I'm kind of in a nice triangle, and that's why I really moved west. And the sports idea was really just a transition from being a businessman my whole life, kind of working with obscure public companies that did really well. I mean, we were always very successful, but I wanted to have something that would be private that I could own and really be proud of, and make great. That was the whole genesis of the idea.
Well, Seattle just came into the league, was voted into the league, and as an expansion team, they paid $650 million. Your expansion fee was $500 million, so I would say it's a pretty good investment so far.
It's a good investment, you know, but this is a long-term legacy program. So, like most of the other owners, we're in for the long haul. And it's nice to see the numbers, and it makes you feel good, but unless something really strange would happen, I intend on being around this team for a long, long time here in Las Vegas.
Let me ask you, while we're on the subject, have you spoken with the Seattle folks at all? Do you expect to maybe more as they get closer to putting together a team? I mean, they are a couple of years and an entire building away from that.
I've known David Bonderman for quite a few years because he's a financial sponsor, and there've been a couple different occasions that he has invested or thought about investing in some of our ventures. And he's a very, very smart guy. And, of course, Jerry Bruckheimer is a very accomplished individual. And they came down and saw me a couple times. And they were just asking general questions about how we set up the organization and how we what we did to structure it. But they had their own ideas. And I thought, well, I don't need to tell them that much because they seem like they already know quite a bit. I really didn't tell them much.
Well, at least you didn't have to give away any secrets, I guess.
I didn't give away any secrets.
So let's go back to your initial, whether it was affiliation with hockey or just learning to play the game, the sport. Your dad was in the service, right? You moved around a lot. Where did you all live, and how much did you move around?
We moved every 2 or 3 years, and I think toward the end of his career, we might be somewhere 4 years. But he had a 3-year tour in Ottawa, Canada, as an exchange officer. And we got there in October, and I was in second grade. And the only thing you could do in the wintertime is learn how to skate. So I started learning how to skate as a, however old I was, six or seven. And then the next year you started playing hockey. And we skated on the Rockland Canal, and we played pond hockey around the neighborhood. And so I became an addict back in second, third, and fourth grades. And then unfortunately I got away from it because we moved all over.
Now, one thing that, you know, even if, you know, Army brat or whatever branch of the service, the kids that move around a lot, you know, it's not easy. It's, you know, always a new school, always a new neighborhood. Did you have to learn how to make friends quickly? Did it shape you as a kid, all the moving around?
It was really tough, and I really didn't like it because you had a 3 or 4 month period where you're trying to get to know the kids and the new school and the new neighborhoods. Fortunately, a lot of places we lived, we were embedded or we were living near or close to other military families, and they are coming and going, and so it's a little bit it eases it a little bit, but you know, the new kid on the block has always got to kind of prove what kind of person they are, and I think it helped me. It certainly got me out of my shell because I was very shy, you know, as a young kid, and it helped me, just forced me to meet people and talk to them, but it was tough. I'd much rather just stay in one place and grown up in a small town and had all those kinds of experiences.
So from a military family, you really continue the tradition. And for anyone who doesn't know, especially maybe up in Canada, it's impressive to have trained, you know, and gone to college at the U.S. Military Academy, but it's even more impressive to get in. I mean, for anybody who doesn't know the application process, or if you've applied to college or gone to college, or if you have kids that are applying, how did you get into the U.S. Military Academy?
I could never get in today, I can tell you that. Yeah, I played sports in high school, and they wanted well-rounded people that were, you know, pretty stable, normal people. They had their own entrance exams. So you took the SATs, and you had to have your grades and, you know, what you did in high school and all that sort of thing. But then you went to a 2.5-day session where they give you a mental aptitude test, a physical aptitude test, and a medical exam. And you had to pass those, all three of those. And I was actually appointed as a fourth alternate. And the principal broke his wrist before he was supposed to report, so he was out. The first alternate flunked the mental aptitude test, so he was out. The second alternate flunked the physical aptitude test, he was out. And the third alternate flunked the mental aptitude test, and I was in. So I didn't even think I was going to go. I really wanted to go to University of Virginia or William & Mary. Those were my top two choices.
So first of all, it's a perfect example of you have to be ready when opportunity knocks, right? Because you were a fourth alternate, and here you were getting in. So I'm sure that served you later in life. What do you remember about your time there?
I didn't like it at all. It was terrible.
Okay.
Cadets generally, they're about a third that are rebelling, a third that are trying to be invisible, and a third that really want to achieve and love the Army. And I was kind of in that rebellious / invisible third. I didn't want anyone to know who I was. I didn't want to get in trouble. I just wanted to survive and get through the place. But eventually the rebellious streak kind of came together, and I ended up being on the area a little bit and having to walk a few hours. So I appreciate what West Point did. West Point shaped me and formed my mental, my attitudes. It gave me the background. I then applied in business, and I applied in the military, but I also applied it in business, and it really worked, and it's been very successful. So it's a great place to have gone to school. It's a terrible place to be located. Gray. We have gloom period from January 1st to like March 31st, which is just gray every day. And really, when I was there, and it's still true, we graduated with 220 semester hours, and normally, and from college, you graduate with 120. So we took 6 years of school in 4 years, and we marched, and we trained, and we played athletics, and we did all the other things we did. It was hard work.
Well, Well, it's quite amazing that the military has shaped you the way it has, and you do apply so many of the military principles to your businesses, considering the fact that it was so hard on you that you didn't love it, that you weren't in that third that just wanted to make it their life.
Yeah, I just adapted, and I wasn't going to quit. I mean, and that's one thing West Point teaches you is to never give up, never give in, and never quit. Because when you're a quitter, you really are on the outs at West Point. So I was stubborn, and I made it through. I didn't like it, but as you stayed there longer and longer, by the time you got through your sophomore year, you start getting a little responsibility, and it becomes a little more fun. And then when you're a first classman, you're basically your god. I mean, you get everything done for you. So it does slip around.
Okay, so let's talk about this oft-told story that really set you on your way in business when you left West Point, which was you were able to invest and make, I think, the tidy sum of $40,000 on Wall Street. And what I want to know is, it's not like there were laptop computers in your dorm rooms in the 1960s. There was no E-Trade. How did you do that?
I read some books on technical analysis, so I became kind of a technical trader. And I did my own charts. I looked at the Wall Street Journal the day after, and I updated my charts. I tried to keep track of about 30 stocks, and I tried to pick industries I thought were, at that point in time, were in a position to benefit from the economy. And one of my picks were regional airlines, and they all got merged out of existence, but they all doubled, and so that's where a good deal of the money was made. And then I also got into on some financial services companies that I thought were interesting, and I got I was lucky. The market was pretty good while I was there, you know, so it was probably could have thrown a dart at a board and done almost as well.
Well, I don't know about that, but what did your roommates or your classmates or your parents think about you being so interested in the financial sector there and really having the confidence to invest?
My roommates, the guys there, thought I was crazy. Said, all you're going to do is lose all your money. And I said, well, maybe. Let's see. But I never told them what I was really doing, what I was up to, and how well I was doing. And I bought, after I graduated, I could buy a car when I went on my first assignment. I could lease a nice apartment. It paid off. I eventually spent most of the money. I kind of wasted on women and alcohol. And
did you really?
Oh yeah.
Because the story goes that it's how you bought your first company. How did you buy your first company? Or you were busy enjoying the nightlife?
Well, I got out of the service and I had gotten an MBA while I was in the Air Force, and then I went to law school. And I married my wife, still married, the same woman, and she was a flight attendant, so she really kind of put me through law school. And then I became a lawyer and started making a little bit of money, and I had a knack. I really had a knack for the business side of the legal profession. And I realized after about 7 years that I could either work as an hourly worker or I needed to own a business. And so I put together a small group that we overpaid for a small title insurance company in Phoenix, Arizona, and we scraped together, I think, $2.5 million on a $21 million purchase, and we got the company bought, and the rest is just hired good people, and now I don't have to do any work. They do all the work.
So what would you say your style was at that time? Were you shrewd, aggressive? I can't imagine you were cautious. How did you acquire, if the numbers I read are right, some 80 acquisitions to turn that small title insurance company in Phoenix into the biggest title insurance company in the country?
Yeah, we always, I was always a value buyer, and we were making a lot of acquisitions, and the competition always said, well, he's crazy, he's out, he's just going to go under, he's borrowing too much money, he's doing this. And we actually doing that, and we actually never really borrowed any money. We kind of used cash on hand and small borrowings. But we did value purchases. We tried to buy companies below book value that had hard assets greater than what our purchase price was. And we bought about $40 million worth of cash and investments and stocks for $20 million. That was the kind of thing we did. We really just sort of were around the fringes as we built the company in trying to expand our footprint, trying to expand our base of operations. Still being conservative, trying to be careful because we had all of our money tied up in this thing.
So as you're talking, I'm picturing the Golden Knights, the value picks, players from other teams that you saw value in. You did your research. You brought them in. Is there some comparison to be made there to the players you brought in?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the preparation that we went through in terms of the first thing I did was I tried to hire a really good general manager who was experienced. I interviewed 7 or 8 people, but the first time I talked to George on the phone, I knew he was my guy. I knew that he wanted to win and that he didn't want anything to stand in his way of winning the Stanley Cup, period. And so he and I had that, we have that in common, this kind of desire to win and be victorious. And then George started picking really strong people, and we talked about them. You know, the scouts he obviously hired without my input, but the director of player personnel and assistant GM and so on. You know, I talked to all those guys. I wanted to make sure that we had a group of individuals that were low ego, low maintenance, and wanted to be part of a team and get the job done. So it's really like the Army. It's all for one and one for all, and it's team, and there's no I in team. So when we had early on more on the business side than the hockey side, we had a few people that were more about the I part. We just moved on. We just said, well, this isn't going to work for us. We want team players, low ego individuals who have a common goal in mind. And those are some of the principles I took from my business experience. So it really wasn't overly complicated.
I did read that you said when you were setting up the front office that there was one mistake you made, but you corrected it and moved on. Was that it, when you sort of changed some personnel there?
Yep. Didn't have the right couple of the right guys. And we need to have the right people. And we do now. Yeah, I'm a little bit of a fault finder. So I always want to improve and keep on getting better and better. But I would say that we've got a really strong staff that is focused on selling tickets, getting sponsorships, doing the right TV deals, drafting the right individuals into the system, trying to improve the team at all times without messing with the integrity of the team, the character of the team. Because our guys have great character.
What kind of relationship do you have with the players?
I'm kind of a father figure, really. I have lunch with them every day that they're practicing. Sometimes I have breakfast. I know them all by their first name. I know most of their wives or girlfriends. I don't try and intrude. Unless I'm invited to sit with them, I'll sit over with the trainers or the coaches or so on. But I don't make speeches. You know, a couple a year, not too many, and they're short. But after every game, I go to the locker room and I congratulate them and I thank them for their hard work. That's kind of my routine, and I feel like if I'm around them and I get to know them, and they know that I'm going to do whatever I can for them to make them more successful, that we'll have a better team, and that's what we try and do.
Do you treat your players different than maybe other quote-unquote employees that you've had over the years? Do you see them differently?
Well, they are different because they're professional hockey players, and they play hockey for a living, and that is their mantra. But the whole team aspect is exactly what I've created at Fidelity or at Black Knight, our mortgage processing company. Team effort, low ego, low maintenance. I probably am a little different with the players than I am with just regular employees in some of the companies.
Is there something that the NHL is a business, not that it's lacking, but that you'd like to see it take more advantage of? What would you say about the NHL as a business?
I'd say the commissioner does a really good job. You know, he's trying to herd 31, now 32 cats, and all different personalities, all different kinds of backgrounds. He's now gotten to move the NHL to the point where it's financially very strong. His owners over the last decade or two are very strong financially. So they don't have this guys that fail or they get themselves in financial trouble and the team that is in trouble. So I think he's really done an excellent job. I don't get very involved in NHL affairs. I feel like, you know, my job is here in Las Vegas. It's motivating my players it's making sure we're making the right decisions in the hockey business side and hockey ops side. And it's also making sure that we're community involved, that we're really helping the community understand hockey, play hockey, and then do our charitable side, which our players are great at. I mean, they really stand up and get out and do some difficult things. I mean, whether it's going to a child cancer center, child cancer hospital, which has got to be the toughest. And they, you know, they go in and they talk to these kids and they and make them feel better. I'm just very proud of I'm proud of hockey players in general, and I'm really proud of our team.
Yeah, your team, as all the teams do, does an amazing job with that. I will say, I went once when I was a young reporter with Pat LaFontaine, who's as does as much charity work full time as any player, into a wing, and honestly, Bill, after the second room, I was hyperventilating in the hallway. It was so difficult to see the kids like that, and I so admire these players that visit and they brighten not only the kids and the families, but the nurses and the doctors that have made it their life's work.
I know it's tough. It's really tough. We went through the terrible thing that happened here was the October 1st massacre and 58 people killed. And the players, if you think about it, we were just starting our first season, and the players had been here maybe less than 2 weeks when that happened, and they were starting the preseason was going on, and we called on them to go to police stations and fire stations and go to hospitals and the civic center where a lot of the people were looking for loved ones and wondering if they were still alive or not. And boy, they stepped up and they went to all these places, and by being out there in the community, the community embraced us. We were already going to do well, but the community embraced us, and the players embraced the community. So I know there's a high degree of interaction and relationships with all the communities and all the NHL teams, but we've jump-started it here. We really are tight with our community.
The event, I guess, that's become known now as 1 October. How are things now? How often do you think about it, or is it brought up, or is it sort of ever-present?
It's ever-present, because if we always recognize a first responder at every game, and then we also have a hero of the game. And generally speaking, they are either military people or they're people that are involved in the first response to tragedies. And we have a very, very close relationship with the Clark County Police Department or Sheriff's Department and the Fire Department. And I'm proud of the fact that we have firefighters and teachers and lawyers and doctors and paralegals and police and sheriffs. I mean, that's our fan base. We're not people thought we were just going to be selling to casinos and the arena would be full of opposing fans. And we did have too many opposing fans last year, but I can tell you we fixed it this year.
How'd you do that?
We don't sell them tickets.
That's the way to go.
and a couple of guys that take me said, well, you know, we could make more money. I said, I don't want to look over there and see Minnesota Wild jerseys in Section 215 filling it up. I'm not going to have it. So I don't care if we give the tickets away. We're not going to give them to the other fans. We've set it up so that if you were coming to town, you're a Blackhawks fan, and there were 16 of you and you wanted to get a block of seats, we'll only sell you blocks of four. So you can't sit with the other 12. The other 12 are going to be blocked out in blocks of four, and they may be in completely. They're in different sections. They're scattered all around. So we don't want any momentum being created by opposing fans.
I don't want to call your start a magical run because that somehow intimates that it was magical and not hard work and the right draft choices and finding value like we talked about in William Karlsson or Marc-Andre Fleury or some of the players that you did find that had such good years for you. But you said at the time there were times where it felt fragile, that you weren't sure it was going to last. And then you start this year and you weren't winning every game. How has the process come along for you with the team?
Yeah, I think, you know, last year we were all kind of pinching ourselves because the guys were doing so well and they were playing so well. But when you listen to the media, well, it's a fluke. It's a joke. They'll never get it. Just wait till Thanksgiving. They'll be out of the playoffs. And then we weren't, of course. And then, well, around Christmas time, they're going to fold. And we didn't. And then it's, well, the All-Star break, that's the real deciding factor, because then the big boys start really playing hockey, and we kept on going. And then it was the trade deadline. And then suddenly we were in the playoffs. And my seminal moment was in early December of a year ago, and we were doing well, and Malcolm Subban was just coming back. We were down to our fourth goalie, and he was just coming back. And we played Nashville and Dallas away, and we beat both of them. And I thought, you know, we really are for real.
So we're talking about your Knights. It's very defined what Knights stands for. Share that with us and your thoughts about that and how the team has embraced that.
Well, when we thought about a name, and we were very fortunate in that we could create our culture. Most people, when they come into a team, whether they're general manager or new ownership with a new general manager, there's a culture already established with that team. And to change the culture, you've got to do it one player at a time, and you may never get it changed. Well, we had the ability to create our culture. So we took a military-style culture and implemented it here at the team. And if you notice, our players are basically clean-shaven. They're pretty grooming's pretty good. They always wear a coat and tie. They when they're away from the locker room, they are a very disciplined bunch of guys. And the night interface to that was, as I started talking to them about it, and I said, the Knight is the epitome of the warrior class. The Knight never retreats, always advances, never gives up, never gives in. And I just kept on repeating it and repeating it. And eventually it takes hold. People start believing it. Our whole locker room downstairs has got all kinds of kind of martial imagery. And the guys love it. When I showed them pictures last spring of, here's what we're going to do to your locker room to really make you part of something special, they were like, you're really going to do this? You're going to spend all this money? And I said, yeah, we are. This is part of our culture.
So describe that for us, for anyone who's not been in the room.
Yeah, we don't have many people in there, as a matter of fact. Well, the lounge room has two large Golden Knights and a Stanley Cup between them, and it says the Quest. We have pictures of not necessarily players, but players without their faces really being revealed in various positions playing hockey, and then we have quotes all over the place. All quotes that I've kind of grabbed from other places, or George picked up on in his hockey life. And one is, fear is an emotion, courage is a choice. Got some Winston Churchill quotes, and George said, well, do you want all these quotes? I said, just trust me, George. These are good.
Trust me.
These quotes are okay.
They've worked for centuries.
They've worked for centuries, absolutely.
Let's go there next, because you didn't want to choose overall a military life. And one of the reasons, I'm guessing, is it was such a turbulent time in the late 60s, and then it was the Vietnam War. I was reading about the Fenn Center, the state-of-the-art lacrosse sports complex that you were a part of building at the military academy. And part of that is named for one of your classmates that did perish in the Vietnam War. How did that affect you as a young man and into your later years, having classmates that did go to war? I mean, it's something that if it's been a part of your family or it's happened to you, you can relate. But so many young people and even older folks today can't relate to that and don't have any experience with that.
We were at West Point. The Vietnam War was getting hot. But guys didn't start really getting killed until 1965. And that's when it started, really came back to us. And basically my entire class went to Vietnam. We had 584 guys graduated. 30 were killed in Vietnam, if you can believe that.
Wow.
It's just unbelievable. And Mike Nacy and Ray Enners are two of the guys on the Fenn Center. They're both my very close friends. Mike Nacy was my best friend. So it was it had a big impact on me. And I decided after I got out of the military, and I really wanted to be a lawyer. I thought I wanted to be a lawyer my whole life, and I wanted to go to law school. And I became successful in business. I thought, you know, these my poor classmates and people that graduated from West Point, other military folks, really never make any money. And I was fortunate to have been fairly successful. And so I said, well, I need to give back. I need to get back to the school because I'm one of the few guys that can really afford it. So I built the Foley Athletic Center, which is the indoor athletic facility by Mikey Stadium. And then they came back to me and said, would you help with the lacrosse center? And I said, yeah, I will. No problem. And so now we have a state-of-the-art lacrosse center, the Fenn Center. And when we're talking about naming it, it's Foley Enners Nathy, but the athletic director said, it was going to be called Foley Nathie Enners. And he said, can you call it Foley Enners Nathie? Because it'll just become the Finn Center, because everything's an acronym up here.
Let me ask you this. So of all the things that you have done, and you have much more to accomplish, and I'm sure many more things on your to-do list, your success in business, or what you've been able to give back to West Point, or owning the Vegas Golden Knights, what brings you the most joy these days?
The Vegas Golden Knights are bringing me the most, having the biggest impact on my life. It's everything is about game day and what's going on in that game and going to the game. And I sit with George McPhee and Kelly McCrimmon. We sit in a little row in a suite, and we sit in the same spot every game. I wear the same clothes, the same basic clothes. Not like, you get them cleaned, but we're the same basic clothes. George wears the same stuff. So does Kelly. I mean, we're not superstitious, but we are creatures of habit, I guess. The Golden Knights are the most fun for me. My other latest project is I started a foundation or a charitable organization called the Folded Flag Foundation, which benefits the surviving spouses and children of servicemen or women killed in combat. So that is that's a big motivating factor for me now. And we're doing really well. We're still small. I think we raised close to $10 million last year. But every time we do it, we have our budget, and each person is basically ends up will spend $150,000 to $200,000 per family by the time we're done with doing what we do. So we're helping a lot, and the next goal is to really kind of get on a national TV program, do some advertising, because this particular foundation, all of the expenses are paid for by some of my public companies. So every dime that goes into the Folded Flag goes right to the beneficiaries.
One thing I'm going to take away from this podcast is that you are as generous as you are sharp. You seem to genuinely enjoy giving away some of the fortune that you've made. And if you can't do that, right? I mean, you can't take it with you, right?
No, you can't. That's what we try and do. We try and be good citizens and pick up the slack.
Are you worried about maybe losing Kelly McCrimmon to the other expansion franchise, since he did such a good job with yours?
He's done great. He's a great friend. I've always felt that if someone has an opportunity that they feel is good for them, and hockey is a little bit unique because a lot of the assistant GMs then ultimately want to become the GM and they want to run their own show. I certainly wouldn't want to lose Kelly. He's helped build a great team here along with George, and he's a different kind of personality than George, so they're great. They're terrific together. But, you can never stand in someone's way. We'd have to just go out and try and find a better Kelly McCrimmon.
So you're putting a little pressure on the Raiders now, who the NFL's going to join you in Vegas in 2020, putting a little pressure on the Raiders.
We have a different fan base, honestly, and I hope they do really well. They're going to have a great stadium, and I wish them well. But coming here is great. It's great for Las Vegas. Las Vegas is a very it only has about 2.2 or 2.3 million people in the town. Might be more now because people are moving here like crazy. But we have 43 million visitors a year, and I believe the Raiders will get a lot of visitors.
Tell me a couple of your favorite things to do in Vegas when you're not at a game or working in the offices.
I play golf. I hurt my back, so I had a back operation a couple months ago.
Oh.
I'm just now able to get back out and start playing golf again. So play golf, have a lot of good friends I play golf with. That's a fun thing to do. I try and work out every day or every other day in the gym up here at the team, and I have one of the trainers helps me with the Pilates program, which is great because I'm getting old and I need to be more flexible. Then I spent my time kind of talking to George and Kelly. Okay, what are we going to do?
Right.
We're short here. What's going to happen here? Who's out there? What can we do?
And you're into it, and it sounds like from the people that work in your office that because you sat in on the mock drafts and because you were a part of, the process at the beginning, you've come in even in a couple of years, you really know the players, even on other teams, what their strengths are, who's got a good, wrist shot, who's got a good, who hustles in the zone. I mean, you seem to really, you've gotten some enjoyment out of that.
I have, and I'd love to learn. I really do. I love to learn new things, and so I'm learning new things every day in hockey.
So last thing, is there anything, or what is there that you haven't done yet that you'd like to do?
I've told people now that I am not only convinced we're going to win a Stanley Cup, but I want to create a dynasty. I want to be known, have this team known as being a dynasty, winning multiple Stanley Cups over an extended period of time. And that's my next job. That's my next mission.
Mission, right on cue with your military background. Wish you the best in doing that, and that'll mean we'll get to talk to you again. I can't thank you enough for doing this. It was so interesting to chat.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Deb. I appreciate it.
That's Bill Foley. Talk about a life well lived. That is it for this edition of NHL Executive Suite. Don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast at Google Podcast, iTunes, Stitcher, and anywhere else you find your favorite podcast. Until next time, I'm Deb Placey in the NHL Executive Suite.